From San Francisco, welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
By 400 or 500 AD, it had at least 100,000 people, possibly 150,000 or even 200,000, and that made it something like the sixth largest city in the world.
Dr. George Coville is a professor of anthropology at Arizona State University. He has made a lifelong study of Teotihuacan, the first city in North America. Lasting from the time of Christ to 750 AD, Teotihuacan was dominated by its great pyramids, its temples, its stunning murals, and its wide boulevards. Dr. Coville speaks with Moira about the technology of Teotihuacan, how a Stone Age society could build a great city with towering pyramids.
As you see, they've survived, you know, 1,000 years really in fantastic condition. So if they survived underground so well for 1,000 years, we should, in a museum environment, by controlling the humidity and the temperature, be able to preserve them for another 1,000 years.
Leslie Bone is the objects conservator for the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. Under her stewardship, over 70 mural fragments, large and small, were restored. She discusses how these murals were made, what they tell us about Teotihuacan, and the philosophy of using technology in restoration. Now, here's Moira with Dr. Coville.
The first thing, Dr. Coville, for our listeners, how do you spell and then correctly pronounce Teotihuacan?
Well, you just did it right. It's Teotihuacan, and I think the best pronunciation is Teotihuacan, although you hear quite a few people also say Teotihuacan, and that's all right also, but I think I would lean a little bit toward Teotihuacan, which is the more correct way that the Aztecs pronounced it.
Well, tell us about Teotihuacan.
Well, it's a great ruined city. It's about 25 miles northeast of Mexico City, and it's widely supposed that it was something to do with the Aztecs, but in fact, for the Aztecs, it was already in ruins. It was already a legendary city, and the name that we give it, Teotihuacan, means in the language of the Aztecs, something like the place of the gods or the place where people become gods. And they thought that the city was too large to have been built by humans, that it was built by giants or maybe even built by the gods. The largest pyramid covers the same area as the Pyramid of Cheops, the largest of the Egyptian pyramids, which is about 12 acres or something like that.
So the base of the pyramid is 12 acres.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And about when was that built?
That was probably built about the 1st century A.D., about 1900 or nearly 2,000 years ago.
You know, I don't think of cities or that kind of structure being in North America in that period of time. I'm sort of Eurocentric at that point, or Asia. Yes. But here in North America, they have a tremendous big city.
Yes. That the city was already very large by that time, and by 400 or 500 A.D., it had at least 100,000 people, possibly 150,000 or even 200,000, and that made it something like the sixth largest city in the world, compared with Constantinople, a few of the largest cities of China, maybe two or three other large cities around the Mediterranean. Nothing in Northern Europe was anywhere near that large at that time.
Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about a 400 A.D., there's, say, six largest cities in the world. Mm-hmm. One would be certainly Teotihuacan.
Yes.
But like Rome, would that be among the?
I don't think Rome was, by at least by 500 or 600 A.D., I think Rome had already lost a lot of population. If you went back two or three centuries earlier, Rome would have had perhaps several hundred thousand people in it.
So at its peak.
Yeah. So certainly at one time, Rome had a larger population.
But it was still comparable.
Yes.
As we say. I understand there were 2,000 one-story stone and adobe apartment compounds there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an enormous number of buildings.
Yes, but the city covered about 8 square miles, and when you think of 100,000 people or so, then it's going to take that many people to house them.
How did the city grow to be so large?
Around the time of Christ, the city was already had perhaps 20 or 30,000 people in it, but at about that time, they simply moved everybody else in the basin of Mexico, which is an area of several hundred square miles, and moved everybody else from that basin into the city. So it got quite a large influx of people from the countryside. And otherwise, a certain amount of natural increase, but I think the main thing is moving so much of the population into this city. And of course, why and how that happened is still a great mystery. Partly, people were probably attracted by the activity in the city, by its marketplaces, by the temples that were already very impressive by that time. But it still took them a long way from their fields, and it made agriculture significantly less efficient than it would have been otherwise. But of course, that's the time when they started building this enormous pyramid, which has 1 million cubic yards of material in it. And I think part of the reason for moving people into the city was to provide the labor force for that pyramid. But then they just stayed on or kept on after that.
I understand that Teotihuacan was mm-hmm. truly a Stone Age city, that mm-hmm. there was no metal. And in mm-hmm. terms of building a pyramid or building these houses and tools and mm-hmm. things like that, what did that mean?
It certainly meant a lot of hand labor, and for most of them, for the Sun Pyramid, for example, this largest one that I've been talking about, the individual stones are not particularly large. A lot of it's built of rubble and mud and adobe, and it just simply meant an enormous number of people carrying loads up, you know, one person at a time, and depositing that. There are other examples. There's a building called the Temple of Quetzalcoatl, for example, that has stone facing on it with enormous cut stone blocks that weigh up to several tons individually, and they're carved. It's the Feathered Serpent Pyramid, is its other name, and on the cover of that museum booklet you'll see, I think, one of the feathered serpents. And all those things, of which there are several hundred, not only do they weigh several tons, but each one was carved using other stone to shape them.
So stone against stone.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, nothing quite symbolizes technology so much as the wheel, and mm-hmm. yet there was no wheel.
No, without beasts of burden, there was really no particular point in having a wheel. They knew about wheels. We find little toys, little pottery toys with wheels, but they didn't have any use for it for transportation because they didn't have any beasts of burden. The landscape is mostly quite rugged, and to make effective use of wheeled vehicles, you need a good road system. You need a good infrastructure, which is a big investment. There's no point in making that investment if you didn't have draft animals.
Now, the Romans were very big on building roads and mm-hmm. that type of thing. Were these mainly gravel roads or just dirt?
Within the city itself, there are lots and lots of well-defined streets. Outside the city, I don't think they did very much. I don't think they did the kind of thing that we see in Peru with the Incas, for example. But I think they probably had well-maintained trails, but didn't invest very much effort into into that kind of transportation.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. George Kogel of the Department of Anthropology at Arizona State University. And we're talking about the technology of Teotihuacan, the oldest city in North America. In the 1960s, you worked with Dr. Millen to survey Teotihuacan. What data did you collect, and how did you collect it?
I should really say Millen, before I joined the project, defined the perimeter of the city. People had always known how large these pyramids were. In fact, ever since the 16th century, nobody ever lost Teotihuacan. It's difficult to do. But until the 1960s, people had no idea how far the residential areas stretched beyond the pyramids. And the first thing that Millen did in the very early 60s was to, by walking on the ground, define a perimeter of the city, find out how large it was, and then contracted to have aerial photography to make stereoscopic pairs of air photos from which a topographic map could be drawn from that kind of photographic control. We then used 500 by 500 meter sheets drawn from those aerial photos and walked over the whole 20 or 30 square kilometers of the city and its surrounding areas, and field by field did a careful survey and noticed all the architectural remains we could find, all the remains of floors or walls or any other building remains, and made systematic collections of the pottery fragments, the obsidian fragments, any other remains of tools or artifacts that could be found on the surface of these sites without, of course, excavating them, but simply walking over the surface, and systematically made collections, something like 5,000 separate collections, and recorded the data, put it into computer files, drew in the information on these maps, and then in 1973 published a volume that just shows the individual map squares.
So it took almost 10 years then to go through and just walk around and collect the data and finally put it all together.
Yes. And in fact, as far as the collected material is concerned, we're still analyzing material that was collected, something like 900,000 pottery fragments, 200,000 pieces of obsidian, and tens of thousands of other kinds of objects.
You know, it's amazing. Many times what happens to a city is that another city develops on top of it and another mm-hmm. city on that. And so mm-hmm. so much of what one could find is crushed or removed or mixed or, you know, jumbled up. Mm-hmm. For the most part, no city, no other settlement in all these kilometers really grew up on top of it, right?
After Teotihuacan's collapse, which was probably in the 7th or 8th century A.D., there's been a population there ever since, but it's been essentially small towns. And right at the moment, Teotihuacan is threatened more, I think, than ever before, because with the population explosion in Mexico now, the modern towns are just, again, exploding in population. New housing is going up all over the place, and only about a third of the site is protected by the archaeological zone. About two-thirds of it is outside and is being rapidly destroyed now by modern building.
It's amazing. It can last all these years, and suddenly it's being gone just when other technology is coming about that could help us understand it.
Well, unfortunately, technology is a double-edged sword, and we have things like bulldozers and deep plows and superhighways and all sorts of things, so that technology at the moment in many ways is one of the biggest threats to Teotihuacan.
Okay, let's go back to analytical geometry. How tall is the Sun Pyramid?
Okay. Yeah, well, it's not as tall as the Egyptian pyramid. It's about half as high, and it's about 60 meters, which I think works out to a little less than 200 feet, but close to 200 feet.
So that their buildings were all one story, with the exception of, I guess, the temples and the pyramid. So it mm-hmm. certainly soared above anything around it.
Yes, just as it does today.
Well, when you go to the top of the the pyramid, the mm-hmm. Sun Pyramid, and you mm-hmm. look around, what is that like?
Well, I could answer that in one of two ways. One of them is that 80% of the time, if you look to the southwest, you see a dense brown pall of Mexico City smog. But on a clear day nowadays, and probably typically in Tehuacan times, you can look for miles and miles in any direction and see a great distance over the basin of Mexico. You can see past where Tenochtitlan was later built and all the way down to the southern edge of the basin of Mexico. And if you look to the east or northeast, you see the hills and mountains ringing the basin of Mexico. And you just have a wonderful vista in any direction you look.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. George Kogel of the Department of Anthropology at Arizona State University. We're talking about the technology of Teotihuacan, the oldest city in North America. Scientists are not only interested in the data available, they're always fascinated with the missing data, the data not available. What don't we know about Teotihuacan?
Almost everything, I think, which may be too general an answer, but we would like to know, really understand it as a living society. And when we find essentially their garbage, which is what we're working with, garbage on the one hand is where people reveal a lot of things they hadn't meant to reveal about themselves. So in some ways that's very informative. But we don't have any inscriptions. It's not clear that they used writing to any great extent. That also seems incredible for a city that large. But there's a limited use of signs that are just kind of on the borderline of being real writing. And most of those we still don't know how to read. So it was, I'd say, almost a non-literate society, or at least a society that, in spite of its size and complexity, and they must have had some kind of bookkeeping methods, some kind of record-keeping, accounting, and the like, but there doesn't seem to have been anything in the sense of a written literature. And so, again, in that sense, they're really prehistoric, and that makes it terribly difficult for us to understand their religion. We have some idea about their religion because there are lots and lots of murals and carvings and representations of their gods and goddesses. But when it comes to something like their politics, for example, that is extremely obscure, and they don't seem to have been interested in talking about themselves and recording their politics. If you look at the Maya, for example, we now know that Maya inscriptions go on at great length about the genealogies and the pedigrees of Maya rulers, who they conquered, who they married, things like that. We have none of that for Teotihuacan, so it's horribly difficult to really try to reconstruct many aspects of their society, but we keep trying anyhow.
Now, do we know what language they spoke?
No.
Do they have money?
Not in any sense close to what we would think of. Yeah, yes.
They didn't have metal, so they couldn't have coins.
That's right. Later on in Mesoamerica, people used cacao beans, what we make cocoa out of, as a medium of exchange. And there are some representations of cacao and trees and cacao beans in Teotihuacan art. So it's reasonable to think that they may also have used something like the cacao bean as a medium of exchange, but it still wouldn't be like money in the sense that we think of it.
Okay, so we have 100,000 people mm-hmm. living in all relatively close quarters in 2,000 one-story apartment mm-hmm. compounds, mm-hmm. all relatively close together. Mm-hmm. There's no metal, and there's no wheel, no mm-hmm. draft animals.
Mm-hmm.
So one would presume if you were on one end of this, to get to the other, you'd have to walk all the way across.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that there's, so there's no public transportation.
No, we're talking about a distance of 5 or 6 kilometers. You know, it probably wouldn't take much more than an hour to get from one extremity to the other extremity of the city. And basically, it's large enough, you know, that if you lived anywhere except at the very edge, you could get to most other places you wanted to in half an hour or 45 minutes. And that's not unreasonable.
You know, we don't think of public transportation as being a vehicle by which a city could spread out, but it certainly could. If you have public transportation that moves, mm-hmm. your city can be much larger. And
yes.
just by the fact that everyone was on foot, it would bring mm-hmm. it closer together so that you would have mm-hmm. access to everyone.
Yes, yes. I think it was the same way with European cities and even with cities in North America in the colonial period, that most people lived within, you know, 45 minutes of walking distance of practically anything they might want to go to. And we don't think very much about a 45-minute trip by public transportation.
Interesting. What about sewage? Do they have a sewer system?
Well, there are lots of drains, and the major reason for the drains is probably to carry off rainwater, because although it's quite dry at some times of the year, during the rainy season, you can have very heavy downpours, and these houses would quickly fill up with water if they didn't have drains to carry off the water. And so there's quite a well-developed drainage system. And how much of that served for sanitation, I don't know. I suppose any time there was a heavy rainstorm, just the amount of water running through these drains would have had an effect of flushing things out. But in terms of things like human waste disposal, we suspect that they may have, you know, just used chamber pots or something like that. And then, again, this is just guesswork, but it's plausible to think that they might have used human waste products as fertilizer out in their fields or something like that.
If they didn't have apparently have a written word, would they have a post office? Would they have a mail system?
That never even occurred to me before. I don't think so.
My contribution to your work.
Yes. No, I don't think they would have had anything like a letter system.
Now I won't spend too much time on the rumors of sacrifices which rip out the beating human hearts.
Oh, those aren't rumors. They're very real.
Really? Mm-hmm. Well, what did they do?
Well,
that we think they did. What do we know?
Well, for the Aztecs, we have very circumstantial accounts, and even though some of them may be somewhat exaggerated, there's certainly no doubt that the Aztecs sacrificed lots of the people, young men captured in battle, that they really did have their hearts, their chest cavity opened with a stone knife and their heart ripped out of it. In the case of Teotihuacan, we don't see this actually graphically being displayed, but there are a number of both mural paintings and decorated pots that show processions of priests holding obsidian knives, and impaled on each knife is a heart dripping blood. So this is, in effect, the aftermath of that kind of operation.
Yeah, it certainly suggests they at least had the idea.
Oh, I think I'm sure it's more than just a suggestion and more than just an idea that this heart sacrifice was not an invention of the Aztecs, that it goes back much earlier in Mesoamerica.
When do you next visit Teotihuacan?
I'm going down there on the 14th of July.
Mm-hmm. Right away.
Mm-hmm.
What work have you planned?
Well, we're still... I was associated with the group that excavated more than 100 sacrificed individuals at the Temple of Quetzalcoatl in 1988 and 89, and these people, incidentally, did not have their hearts torn out, but nevertheless were sacrificial victims. And we're still doing the report on that 1989 work.
So you're still working to bring that together.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What work would you ultimately like to do?
Given how large a site is, in spite of the enormous areas that have been excavated, it's still just a few percent of the whole city. I'd say 90 or 95% of it remains unexcavated. And there's a tremendous amount just of raw data that still is there to be gained. And, of course, it's not sufficient to just dig it. We then have to analyze it and understand it. But the first step is excavating it. So there's just an incredible amount that remains to be done in terms of the excavation of Teotihuacan.
I'm sure this kind of a question can be unnerving, because people who don't know a lot about anthropology will often ask it. And that is that, well, we know you're studying what's going on there then, but what can the study of Teotihuacan do for us in the future?
On one level, I think that just knowing the past, knowing that a lot of our assumptions about what life is like in the past are not necessarily right, I think that that's very valuable. Understanding, for example, what these people accomplished without metals and without draft animals and without many other things that we think of as technologically almost essential is one kind of valuable lesson. Otherwise, I think maybe when we understand their political system better, that can also help us to understand the variety of political systems that are possible in the world, the variety of social arrangements. And I would also have to say that I think one question is the extent to which technology really drives everything else in society. If you look at a place like Teotihuacan, I think you become a little bit skeptical of that and think that certainly technology is important, food is important, all sorts of things like that, or you can't ignore them, but it really looks like that's not enough. It really looks like, I think you get drawn more and more toward the mental life, and I might even say the spiritual life in some ways of people. And I think understanding how the people of Teotihuacan thought and felt is something that just opens our minds to more and different possibilities.
Moira's guest has been Dr. George Cogill. He is now traveling to Teotihuacan to continue his anthropological research. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with Dr. Moira Gunn. Leslie Bone is the objects conservator at the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. She describes the murals of Teotihuacan, what they teach us, how they were made, and how they were restored.
Leslie, tell us about the murals of Teotihuacan.
The murals of Teotihuacan are a tremendous insight into this culture, because here is one material where we can see actually a figurative representation of life at that time, or at least ritualistic life of that time. So it's a fantastic way of getting an idea of what went on during that culture, what the people perhaps wore during their ceremonies, and you know, some of perhaps the ritual things that went on.
How did the Fine Arts Museums become interested in these murals?
Well, it was, you know, one of those strange things that one day our chief curator, who was Tom Seligman at the time, got a phone call from a bank saying that we had been left a bequest of pre-Columbian material, and the bank wasn't sure what it was. And we do get very strange calls at the museum, so Tom, I think, sort of assumed, oh, it's another one of those calls. So I don't know how seriously he took it initially. Anyway, about a few weeks later, he went with the bank manager and the key down to Jackson Square, which was the house of Harold Wagner, who was a gentleman who had left us this bequest, and proceeded to walk into this house, and three floors of this house were just covered with murals from Teotihuacan. And Tom was just stunned. I mean, it was just amazing. I don't think he'd ever seen so much wonderful pre-Columbian material in one place at one time.
Now, how much was there?
There was probably about 70 to 100 fragments of murals, obviously ranging in sizes, but apparently they were spread out on tables and on the floors, and so it was very dramatic to see all this material.
How big are they and how thick are they? And
it's the thickness of the murals varies from about 3 inches to about 5 inches, I would say, and the biggest chunks are about a meter square. And then they range to tiny little 1-inch by 1-inch fragments. Some of the fragments join together, so if you go to the museum today, you'll see a big serpent mural which extends across the whole length of a wall. Well, obviously when Tom saw those were in 12 separate fragments. Now they appear as one, but they certainly weren't when Tom went to see them in this house.
Do we have any idea how Mr. Wagner came in possession of these?
He had a house in Mexico, and it is assumed that the sort of locals in Mexico knew that he had a tremendous interest in pre-Columbian art and that he was an architect, so he tended to like, you know, big, chunky kinds of objects. And so I think that he was approached and offered these murals for sale, and he just loved them. He just fell in love with them. He loved decorative things, too, and these murals are very decorative and have wonderful designs on them. So I think he just fell in love with them and bought them and then brought them up. They were brought up to San Francisco. He actually received them in San Francisco, so although he may have seen them in Mexico, they were actually sent to him in San Francisco. This is where he received them.
And when I see pictures of them, it's not all squared off. I mean, they were sort of crudely picked out. I mean, did that damage them?
It damaged them to the extent that the looters had to decide, you know, how big a chunk they would take off the wall. And so they would sort of mark out a design and then remove a design so that maybe the area between linking designs is missing. And usually that's an area of just one color, usually red. And so the actual design wasn't lost, but what, of course, is lost is a linkage between one piece and the next.
Uh-huh. This is obviously well before any of the rules and the laws of removing objects from countries. And has a lot of these murals been returned now?
Right. We proved to all the legal parties that were interested that those murals had been taken out of Mexico before the 1970 UNESCO Convention. So in terms of that, we really weren't duty-bound to return the murals, but the museum did feel that they would like Mexico to have some of these murals, to return some of these murals back to Mexico. And so there was an agreement made with Mexico in which we would return more than half the murals to them and keep the other section here in San Francisco.
What are on the murals? What do we see on the mural?
The murals are very ornamental. They're highly dramatic. I think of the Teotihuacan people as being people that just love drama. It's, you know, they loved red, and the backgrounds are these sort of deep maroon red, and all the sort of figures are in lighter colors, so they almost jump to the surface. They vibrate on the surface as the red background disappears back. And they're usually of either deities, either people dressed up as sort of animals, because animals had different kinds of powers which they sort of liked and took, you know, the warriors took certain jaguars, for instance, a jaguar as an emblem of good fighting power. Or there are also animals that are dressed like people. So again, I think there's this sort of priestly warrior idea of taking powers from different animals and sort of paralleling that with human endeavors.
You know, it seems that so much of what we know about Teotihuacan can be found in those murals, because we can see people and activities and that type of thing, as opposed to a block of stone.
Right, that's the wonderful thing about them, is that you see flowers, and I'm sure in time we'll be able to identify what kind of flowers are depicted on the murals. As you say, you see little people sort of rushing around doing different things. You see a lot of animals, a lot of different birds, some of which have been identified. You see butterflies. I'm always curious to know. I wonder whether Teotihuacan wasn't an area where butterflies came and migrated to, because that is such a pervasive symbol throughout Teotihuacan. Be interesting for a butterfly expert to look into that. And they also have tremendous decorative designs, and along a lot of the edges of the murals there are footprints, and they use that symbol an awful lot, and it would be sort of really interesting to find out really what that meant to them.
Now, is it like the footprint of, you know,
of a human being, and it's correct to left, right?
So really?
Yeah. It's really fascinating. And there's a lot of water symbology. Obviously, this was an agricultural society that relied tremendously on the seasons and on the arrival of water at the right time. And so throughout these murals, you'll see references to water, raining, in terms of raining, in terms of raindrops, in terms of tears coming from eyes. You'll see water in reference to the sea. You'll see a lot of images of shells, both from the Pacific coast and the Atlantic coast. There's, you know, water in reference to sort of storms. There is really a tremendous lot of water imagery, which you would expect with an agrarian society.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Leslie Bone, Objects Conservator for the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. And we're talking about the murals of Teotihuacan, the oldest city in North America. Now, what are these murals made of? How are they made?
The murals are made out of a volcanic ash backing. I'm not sure whether they didn't just use some kind of river silt material that they found that had the right kind of consistency, because you have to remember that this area was a highly active volcanic area, so the rivers would have had nice silt deposits in them. And it's conceivable that to this they added some kind of clay mud material to make it just the right stickiness for the backing. I discovered in examining the backing material, I found big chunks of charcoal and even pieces of pottery, handles from pottery. Now, whether those were intentionally put into the backing material to help its consistency, or whether they happened to be inclusions, we do not know. But if they were inclusions, the craftsmen didn't remove them, so they obviously felt that they helped, you know, in the drying procedure of this material. And they would apply this to a wall, usually a wall that had been lined with a slate-like material. And this material is usually applied 2 to 3 inches thick. As I say, it was very ungraded, so you had big lumps and little lumps in it. And they just applied one coating, but then they really worked the surface. They have, you can see at the site, several volcanic stone tools that they made for just smoothing the surface, and they really knew how to work that surface to get it absolutely smooth and flat, ready to take the next layer. And the next layer is just incredible. It's usually 1 millimeter thick, and it's a really white lime plaster, calcium carbonate, which is applied to this gray mortar. And they just must have been such marvelous technicians, because they knew exactly the wetness with which to apply this so that it would adhere just tenaciously to this backing. I went to the site a month ago to look at some new plaster that had just been exposed, because I was always a little skeptical and wondered, well, I wonder how much consolidant have been applied to these walls. But this was plaster that had just been exposed, and it was incredible. It could have been put on those walls yesterday. The condition was so fantastic.
When we're talking about this 1 millimeter thick sort of plaster layer, first of all, 1 millimeter is not very thick. I mean, that's very thin.
Right.
For starting. And the ability to get any surface very flat is no mean trick. I mean, that's hard from a technological standpoint. And so they would get it extremely flat, and then they would apply this. Do you think it was like a liquid that they applied that dried, or do you think that in the sort of plaster that it was something that they again polished, or what do you think it was?
I think that they made it into a very sour cream consistency.
Mm.
That's the kind of consistency I think they would have applied it to the walls. And because the surface in which they applied the pigment had to be wet.
Mm.
And so it was amazing, because they had to think of the next process along the way. So they had to do just enough wall that they knew that it would maintain the right amount of dampness for them then to come in and paint the walls with their designs. And
so you put a fresh layer of this sort of white plaster material on there, white sour cream material, we're calling it.
That's just a consistency.
That's a consistency. Right. But it's still wet. And then it was time to paint.
And they may have had, you know, knowing these kind of very rigid societies, they may have had, you know, a plasterer. And then as soon as he'd finished, someone else would step in who would be just the surfacer. And then someone else stepped in and they would be just the painters. So that, you know, it wasn't the same man perhaps doing the sequence of work. They would have specialists doing these different techniques. And so then the painters would come in, and it's very interesting. In the murals that I've worked on, and they're probably all of a later period, they're probably all of around 600 to 750 AD, I see a tremendous confidence. I don't see very much underpainting. I don't see sort of that they quickly did a little sketch on the white before they did their main drawing. I see a little bit where they took a taut line and pinged it against the surface to take vertical lines and horizontal lines, but not very much. I only see that occasionally. So that these people had a tremendous knowledge of the technique and a tremendous confidence, and they went in and painted all the lighter colors first, and then the medium colors, and then they painted this, usually the red background that you see on all these murals. And they had a tremendous knowledge of their pigments, because they, for instance, the pigment they use for green is malachite. And they understood that if you ground malachite too finely, it would no longer look very green. And you can tell that because when they want a dark, vibrant green color, the pigment is much more grainy than any of the other pigments. And so much so that they realized it wasn't going to bind very well to their surface underneath. And so they've, in some places you can see how they've scratched the white surface underneath to help the malachite bind to the surface.
Oh. That's fascinating to me. You were mentioning that many of the murals you worked with were from the later part of the period of Teotihuacan, as we know it. Were there murals throughout, or was there sort of a heyday of murals?
I think the heyday of the murals was when Teotihuacan fell in 750. That's when you're seeing the most sophisticated technique, the really tremendous understanding of the material. They didn't have, we don't think they had mural painting early on. When they built the pyramids, we don't think they had. Those early archaeological digs are not the types of digs that we can do now, which have a lot of scientific backing. So it may be that something was missed and that needs to be reevaluated. But as far as we can tell, we think really of the murals of sort of starting in the early hundreds or 200s AD and then continuing on up till the demise of Teotihuacan, which is 750.
Would you find these inside homes, or would you find them mostly in public, walking down the street? Where would you find these murals?
Up to date, where they've been found is they've been found in public housing, even in some fairly low middle class housing, and they've also been found in temples. So it was obviously something that, you know, was open to everybody. It wasn't just something that the priests kept for themselves. The ordinary householders also had some very complicated and some very phenomenal mural paintings on their walls.
It's amazing to me to think that here was a Stone Age city in one regard, and yet they had all this amazing artwork everywhere.
Right. Well, of course, we have a very European way of looking at things. And, you know, that always stilts our viewpoint. Just because they didn't have metal doesn't mean to say they couldn't do phenomenal things. And if one thinks of for instance, jadeite being as strong as mild steel, then why did they need metal if, you know, they had a material that was as strong as mild steel? So I think we have to be careful about our perspective when we make those kinds of comparisons.
That's right. Now, are there many murals left intact today?
In situ?
Yeah.
Yes, there are. There's at least four apartment complexes that one can visit that have the murals left on the wall, and that's more and more what we're trying to encourage archaeologists to do, to leave them in place, because the murals are part of the architecture of a building, and to have them away from the building not only belittles the building, but you lose a lot from the murals. This was one of the reasons why the murals that we got in San Francisco, we tried to preserve as much of the architectural information as we could. During the time that we got the murals and we were looking into treatment possibilities, the trend at that time in the conservation world was to strip a mural. You faced it, you removed all the backing material, and you were just left with that 1 millimeter lime layer, and you made a new kind of backing. And what you ended up with really was more like a painting. And you lost a lot of the undulating, so you couldn't quite tell where something might have met a curve, or where it had a lip going to something else. And this, in this exhibition that we have at the museum at the moment, it's very interesting because some of the murals on loan have been treated in that manner. So you can compare these murals that were treated to be in someone's American house, and they fit very nicely in a square frame, and then the ones we have in the museum where we've left all the edges, documenting how they were just yanked from the walls, and you can see that. It's very sort of very vivid experience. And I think, that's an interesting thing.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Leslie Bone, Objects Conservator for the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. We're talking about the murals of Teotihuacan, the oldest city in North America. Now, what kind of a restoration process did you go through with the mural fragments that you had?
Because the murals were such a sensitive issue, the museum really, I think, talked to every mural expert in the world before they even touched the murals to do a treatment. We also spent a long time discussing with the Mexicans how they treated their murals in Mexico. Obviously, these are Mexican murals. It seemed logical that they had had the more experience than anybody else. We also felt very strongly that these murals had survived ransacking, had survived a big trip up to San Francisco with all their backing material intact. And we felt that we should honor that. We should try and preserve that backing, even though it might make the solution much more difficult. We also wanted to make sure that the murals could be studied. Sometimes when you frame mural fragments, you have no more access to the rear or the sides of the mural. So we wanted to make sure that scholars could get to the back and the sides of the mural if they want to do any further analysis. So these were all factored into our final decision. So we went for a very conservative kind of decision where we removed very little of the material, created an aluminium frame with...
Excuse me, is that an aluminum frame?
Sorry.
Yes. That's okay. I wanted to make sure I wasn't about to learn something new. It's very sophisticated.
What we designed was an aluminum frame.
Oh, that's okay.
With an epoxy lining which conformed exactly to the shape of the mural at the rear. And this whole framework rests on a wall and hangs at a 15-degree angle, which cradles the mural against the wall, so that you do have a lot of access to all edges in the back of the mural.
Were they very clean? I mean, did they have to be cleaned?
I think for murals, they were very clean from my perspective as an archaeological conservator. Painting conservators may think otherwise. There was a little bit of deposits along the edge, which was a sort of siliceous material, which is really very hard. And where it obscured design, I did remove a little bit very carefully under a microscope with a scalpel. We veered away from using anything strong like acids or EDTA because those kinds of chemicals might change the colors of the murals, and we didn't want that to happen. But overall, there were some mud deposits which were very easy to remove with just swabs of alcohol. And as I say, some murals had the siliceous deposit, but otherwise they were really in outstanding condition.
How do the colors today stand up to, or what do they look like, do we suspect, to the colors when they were originally painted?
I think that some of the colors are probably identical. I think the red that they used was a phenomenal iron. It was a specular hematite, which is very stable, has adhered extremely well to the lime layer, and I think we're seeing it almost identical to how they saw it in those days. I think the colors where you may see a little variance are in the blues. I think some of them probably look a little bit grayer than they did. And in the greens you see a difference because, as I explained to you, the malachite is much more grainy, and so it has tended to erode and come off. And so in some of the green areas, you see the white base material. And in other of the green areas, it's darkened. And my suspicion is that it's darkened either because of the acidic conditions of burial or some acidic treatment and cleaning that maybe was done during Harold Wagner's possession of the murals, because malachite is known to be sensitive to acids. Mm. But overall, the colors have survived incredibly well.
Now, we know we can see many of these murals at the museum exhibit. What else can we see at the exhibit?
At the exhibit at the museum currently, we can see some huge stone sculptures which have been brought directly from the site. They were lying on the site only a couple of months ago, and now they're in the museum. So for me, it's just astonishing to think that. And they were moved very much, I think, in the ancient way in the end, using ropes and
people.
lots and lots of people. And interesting enough, they use a cactus leaf to act as a lubricant as they pulled it along. And I'm sure that's exactly what probably that tells you what kind of people used. So that was sort of very interesting of history revisited. You can also see a lot of wonderful ceramics. These people were technically just had the ceramic technique incredibly developed. They knew the material. They picked out special material. There's some lovely orange ceramics, which is known as orange ware. And they made these wonderful vessels and little animals and different kinds of figures. And the thinness of the body of the clay is fantastic, and the color is just superb. They also loved little things, and there's some little figures of daily life where you can see mothers and babies and different family members, which is really quite an insight into the life then. And we also have sort of rather complex ceramics where we have these figures that are known as host figures, and they open up and inside you see other little figures, or little figures were buried with them in the burial. So it's sort of like a Barbie doll and all her accessories. it's this idea of puzzles, of accessories, of all these little bits that somehow fit together. And we still haven't puzzled out exactly what these host figures were meant to be, and people have different theories about it.
Were there toys that were found in Teotihuacan?
To date, there are some sort of enigmatic things that it's conceivable that they might be toys. Most of the digs so far really have sort of focused on burials, and so it's hard really to make that determination. But they're these puppet-like figures where they're made of clay, and the arms and the legs and sometimes the heads are separated, and they're all tied with string. Some people do think that these puppets were used to demonstrate childbirth, but it is conceivable that these puppet figures were dressed up and used by children as some kind of doll, some kind of toy. I think that's the kind of thing that we still need to do some digging to find out more about. And as I say, there's a lot of apartment complexes that as yet have not been discovered, have not been opened. And so I think once a few more are open, those kinds of questions will be answered.
So we know that they're there. We just haven't opened them up to take a look
right.
at them.
Right. There's still hundreds of apartment complexes that haven't been opened.
What do these apartment complexes look like?
What they are is sort of a series of a lot of tiny rooms that all lead one from the other, with central courtyards where I suppose the family would gather. And in the center of these central courtyards, we're finding what might be little altars. And in the latest excavation I went, they found the altar, and there was a bird figure on it, which is rather wonderful, like a chicken, a big chicken. So, you know, this must have had something to do with the daily ritual, the daily sort of devotional ritual, because they think that every apartment complex must have followed this kind of devotional ritual, and then they had these central altars which they all went to and did whatever ritual was required of them. But anywhere, you know, from I think 10 families could live in these apartment complexes to maybe 20.
So they're quite large.
But some of the rooms are very tiny. You know, when I go in there, I feel very claustrophobic, and I think, oh, how is it possible to live in here? But You forget how different space is when it's actually the proper size and height. And as I say, most of the walls are just covered in these wonderful murals. So, you know, at least you had that distraction.
That is an interesting concept, because we think there's 100,000 people and they're so close together. Well, obviously, today we'd say we'd build up. But these were all one-story homes, or one-story buildings, rather.
That's right, one-story apartment. Well, they still call them apartment compounds, but they were one-story, and they sort of like a Warrens. They sort of went from one room to the next and sort of twisted and turned and went this way and that.
You know, when you were talking about the various things that you were doing to preserve or restore the murals, I couldn't just help but think of all the complexities of conserving objects and the decisions you have to make. How much of the technique of conserving objects is science, and how much of it is an art?
It's really a mixture of both. The requirements to do the postgraduate degree in conservation is either a chemistry background or an art history background. And if you have the art history background, then you're required to do a lot of chemistry to make that up, and vice versa. So, you know, you have to know about the technology of materials. You have to know about the materials that are present. So you have to know how to chemically analyze, or to know where to go and get the materials chemically analyzed. So then that you can make correct judgments as to what treatments would be suitable for that type of material. And again, then the chemicals that you use, you have to know about, and you have to understand how they are going to interact with the material. Because ideally, of course, you want to use everything that's reversible and that it's not really going to really impinge on the older material. In practice, that is really possible, but that's the ideal that we're trying to aim at.
So in the case of the murals, basically we clean them up and is there anything that you would cover them with or spray them with to try to preserve them, or just to keep them in a good place?
Well, as you see, they've survived, you know, 1,000 years really in fantastic condition. So if they survived underground so well for 1,000 years, we should, in a museum environment, by controlling the humidity and the temperature, be able to preserve them for another 1,000 years, barring another major earthquake. So my policy is, and each conservator has a little bit of a different point of view, is to try and do minimal intervention. I prefer to really control the outside factors and not really tamper with the actual object. Especially nowadays, when archaeology is getting so sophisticated and so scientific, where you can take, you know, tiny, for instance, pieces of the surface of a ceramic vessel and find out what kind of materials were cooked in there by analyzing the lipids, you really don't want to be putting any kind of plastic material as a consolidant to really skew those results. So the more we can keep away from tampering with the actual material, I think the better it is for the objects and future scientists.
It is amazing to me that how an object was used, that information could still be part of the object, such as which foods were in the object by studying lipids, obviously left on the surface or bonding with it. But it also addresses the fact that whatever we think we know about it today, as technology moves forward, there's other information in there that we may be able to get tomorrow. So if we tamper with it, we could lose it.
That's right, and that's terribly important in my profession, to keep that foremost in your mind.
Moira's guest has been Leslie Bone, objects conservator at the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. She was responsible for the restoration of the Teotihuacan mural fragments, many of which are on display along with over 200 objects from the National Collections of Mexico and public collections throughout the world. The exhibition, Teotihuacan, City of the Gods, will be presented through October 31st at the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. It was made possible in part by support from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, and by United Airlines. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Special thanks for research support to the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.